Hello and welcome to the second episode of Consumer, the European podcast of the Consumer Choice Center. I am your host, Bill Wirtz, and the man slowly fading out in the background is Billy Joel with his song, Pressure. Thank you for the feedback on the first episode, and for those of you who have been subscribing, Consumer is now also actually listed on Apple Podcasts, so a big welcome to all of you Apple users, and do make sure to leave us a five-star review. My guest later in this episode is the Managing Director of the Consumer Choice Center, Fred Roeder, who is touching two hot potatoes at once, the European Commission's new pharma strategy and the European Green Deal. But more on that later on. First, let me give you some of the consumer updates and some of the consumer topics. Those of you who listened to the last episode will remember me talking about the EU's trade policy. And as we air this show on Thursday, we weren't able to include this magnificent European Parliament debate on the US-EU lobster deal. In the year 2017, I've got this written down here, the United States exported a total lobster value of over 100 million United States dollars to Europe. And so those were charged a tariff of 8%. Now, that will be reduced to zero, and I think rightfully so. It's important to point out that this is a mini deal. This is just a very small trade deal by comparisons of others that have been discussed in the past. But the debate in Brussels quickly went to the bigger issues facing the US and the EU on trade. The rapporteur for this deal, a German Social Democrat member of the European Parliament named Bernd Lange, had this to say. Mind you, he spoke in German and you are hearing the direct translation here.
Maine is one of the places where we get most of the American lobster from. And that is part of the legislation we are considering here today. The American lobster industry really suffered during Trump's tariff trade wars with China. 25% extra was put on top of American lobster.
So that's actually true. The lobster industry was facing quite some difficulties during the Trump time and the Trump tariff war. Later, we'll get to some of the other topics, the other goods that have been included in these kind of trade wars. Let's just continue on the debate. The Polish parliamentarian Danuta Maria Hubner from the center-right European People's Party brought the conversation more to the crux of the issue.
First of all, I would like to thank the Commission for their tireless work towards a positive transatlantic trade agenda, despite the difficult circumstances in those years of dysfunctional trade relations. As Vice President Dombrovskis said, this agreement brings mutual lowering of the tariffs by both sides for the first time in 20 years. And as part of the escalating strategy, it can be a stepping stone toward more vigorous engagement in an open and frank discussion about further reduction of trade irritants in transatlantic relations. There are still many of those, and Bernd Lange mentioned many of them. We have to find negotiated solution regarding subsidies to our airline industries, but we also have to engage effectively in multilateral fora to promote a fair and rules-based global trading system.
Yeah, so a lot of challenges are being addressed here, but I just don't see the ambition of the European Parliament to really go big on trade with America. And what you need to do to see that is the lineup of excuses that many of them will give not to engage with the US. Like, there will always be an excuse not to engage on multilateral trade. At least you could say that Donald Trump was very clear as a protectionist. Some of the issues in the European Union are that people are just not admitting that they hold protectionist views. Let me just give you an example here. Here's German Green parliamentarian Reinhard Bütikofer.
We expect the new Biden administration to understand this. We're willing to engage in broader shared efforts, WTO reform in general, lifting unfair sanctions on EU steel and aluminum, developing effective ways of greening trade rules in order to live up to the challenge of climate change.
We are just not willing to go big on trade, you know, when we talked about in the last episode about TTIP. I think it's important to recognize that things such as this lobster trade deal will remain mini trade deals as long as the European Union does not constructively conclude deals with the US on tariffs and non-tariff barriers. It's easy to blame the trade war on Trump, who has indeed been devastating for trade relations around the world, don't get me wrong. But the reality is also that Europe has its own very protectionist streak. Just to give you an example, EU tariffs on American cars are much higher than US tariffs on European cars. So yes, if you are getting a Chevrolet in Spain, you are paying for it, and not just on petrol consumption. The EU and the US have this ongoing fight over Boeing and Airbus, where both sides are blaming each other, not respecting a fair level playing field. But it's not like the EU doesn't know that there is a petty battle going on here, and then it's just hitting each other with tariffs on different products that doesn't make sense. The EU is very aware of that. Here's a short clip, courtesy of Euronews, report back from March 2018, that quotes former Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker.
Two can play at that game. The warning from the EU pledging retaliatory strikes if President Trump goes ahead with plans to impose import tariffs on steel and aluminium. The countermeasures envisaged by the European Commission President have iconic American companies in their sights. So now we will also impose import tariffs, he said in Hamburg. This is basically a stupid process, the fact that we have to do this, but we have to do it. We'll now impose tariffs on motorcycles, Harley Davidson, on blue jeans, Levi's, on bourbon. We can also do stupid. We also have to be this stupid.
No, I don't think you have to be this stupid. I think you could very much show goodwill and reduce regulatory burdens and tariffs on the European side, and therefore allow the American counterparts to do the same. Now, with an incoming Biden administration, I certainly hope that we're gearing up to go in this direction, but count me skeptical for now. In other news then, the CCC hosted a webinar on Thursday last week on the digital marketplace in Europe. The digital marketplace that describes everything from where you stream your movies, TV shows and music, and where you get your apps or educational software. In the webinar, I like this clip from our guest Manuel Contreras, a Spanish competition lawyer at Herbert Smith Freehills.
I think that we all can recognize that the benefits that the digital companies brought to us. First off, we are streaming this conference via YouTube. There's people in lockdown that can have access to our discussion, et cetera, for free. And that's for sure something that could not happen some years ago. No? And so that's important. I mean, that the digital companies brought to us a lot of good things and should be factored in, right?
Absolutely. I think it's so important to remember the amazing tools that we have at our disposal. FaceTime, Zoom, Facebook, Twitter, Discord, Amazon, you name it, all services you can access free of charge. You can stay in touch with your loved ones and friends, and you can even comfortably yell at me on Twitter out of the comfort of your own home. Speaking of which, you can address said hate mail to bill@consumerchoicecenter.org, where I will most certainly read it and thoughtfully answer it. In this webinar I just mentioned, there was also Alex Saliba, a member of the European Parliament for the Labour Party of Malta. He had this to say when asked about how legislation like the DSA, that's the Digital Services Act, and the DMA, the Digital Markets Act, can help create our own European tech giants.
It is of utmost importance that we create a contestable and competitive environment online, and I believe that the DMA proposal, basically with tackling and creating this black and grey lists so that we create a more competitive environment, will ultimately help out our good innovators. And we have, I can say it out and loud, we have one of the best innovators in the world when it comes to digital infrastructure. This can be reflective of the innovation that we have and the level of good creation when it comes to the apps, app sector. So the potential is there. But I think that the biggest stumbling block for European SMEs, for European innovators, for new European startups is the legislative framework, is the environment, the uncontestable environment, which is dominated by a few players.
So a few things to unpack here. I think it's true that the digital market is dominated by American companies. You have your Microsoft, Amazon, Netflix, and so on. I'll note, though, that Spotify, which is Swedish, represents an exception to that rule here. But now the question is this because of unfair competition? The Digital Services Act of the European Union seems to think so, because it creates a blacklist and a grey list. So the blacklist includes a ban on certain activities. So here the European Commission is targeting things like pre-installing an app on your phone and making it difficult or impossible for you to remove it. If you're getting an iPhone, I have one myself, then the Commission wants to make sure that there's not an excessive amount of pre-installed apps. Also on the blacklist, everything relating to preferential treatment. This is where online platforms rank their search results in a way that that influences you. New legislation also wants to avoid what they call gatekeepers. This is a word used by Digital Market Commissioner Margrethe Vestager from Denmark. She used this word on a Deutsche Welle interview in October.
I also think that we need to say to some of the gatekeepers, there are a number of things that you simply cannot do. Sort of basically regulate from the outset to say, this A, B, C, don't do it. And last but not least, to be able to say, well, we don't want new gatekeepers to arise. We want to make sure that also other digital markets, that they stay competitive, so that more businesses have a fair chance of presenting their services to us as customers.
So gatekeepers is basically what the European Commission calls companies in the digital market realm that are so big that it's really difficult for others to get on the market. That at least is the sentiment. On the surface level, it is easy to agree with Madame Vestager here, because you know, we all want more services and choice in the digital realm. But the question is, of course, is it really by regulating and taxing these companies and ultimately their consumers that we reach this kind of competition? Or could it rather be that it's our own fault that there are no or almost no big European tech giants? Well, fortunately, the reporter at Deutsche Welle asked just the right question, and Commissioner Vestager laid out the actual problem.
Isn't there also the argument that it would also serve competition if we were able to have the conditions here in Europe that would create the equivalent of a European Facebook or a European Apple or a European Google? Why don't we have the equivalent of those companies, and could regulation be getting in the way?
Well, I think we failed 10, 20 years ago in providing a real digital single market. Because one of the reasons why the giants are giants today, and that also goes for the Chinese giants, was that they had a single market. They had a giant home market where they could grow the strength to become global companies. And this is why one side of things is, of course, for society to catch up with the digital development. But the second thing is to provide a real digital single market, also for European businesses to grow, and to provide a capital market with sort of more risk-taking, for instance, venture capital. That comes with capital, but also with knowledge about how to scale up this company, because Europe is incredibly innovative. A lot of things are happening, but we need to provide businesses with the market and with the capital needed.
That was Janelle Dumas-Leon at Deutsche Welle asking just the right question, and Margrethe Vestager giving just the right answer. Something like a digital single market doesn't really exist in the European Union. All you need to do to find this out is you travel to a different country and you connect your Netflix and you try and streaming some of your shows. You'll realize that some shows are not available in some countries. That is something that we've addressed as the Consumer Choice Center. We have been opposing these geo-blocking rules. And we also see that some of the bureaucratic nature of the European Union actually fosters a climate in which digital European companies are not prospering. For more information on that, we have a policy paper from October 2018 titled Liberalizing and Harmonizing European Digital Markets, a paper which you can find under the publications section at consumerchoicecenter.org. But now let's move on to our interview with Fred Roeder, where we talked about both the farmer strategy of the European Union and also about the European Green Deal. All right, we are here with Fred Roeder, who's the managing director of the Consumer Choice Center. Fred is a expert on pharmaceuticals. He's a health economist, so very much in the loop here. I'd like to get his take on the matter. But before we start, Fred, let me play you this first clip here. This is the Commissioner Kyriakides, and she was presenting the pharma strategy at the press conference of the European Commission. So let us listen to this first clip.
I've stood at this podium countless times over the last few months when dealing with this pandemic crisis, and I have heard shared with you the many expectations, the many concerns, the many anxieties that we need to do more in the area of public health in our union. And that's why we presented EU for Health. That's why we went forward and presented the European Health Union. And that is why we're going to be shortly coming forward with the Europe's Beating Cancer Plan.
Yeah, so you heard Commissioner Kyriakides here. Fred, what's your reaction? Is the European Commission going in the right way in order to fight pandemics?
Let's maybe try to dissect this a bit. Okay, so obviously 2020 for all of us has been the year where people increase their focus on public health. We see a lot of innovation happening right now, which is good. I mean, it was unthinkable to have a vaccine just 6-7 months after a new disease has emerged. So that is actually good news. In the good old days, it would have taken us 5 to 10 years to get to something. And now we have 3 products that are about to hit the market. At least 2 of them, if I'm informed correctly, are very novel vaccines. And this is very promising. Gene editing actually has been used to make these vaccines available. So while we probably cannot have a massive deep dive in everything proposed by the Commission, maybe we can just look at a couple of points. I mean, one point is that the EU says they want to strengthen incentives. They want to strengthen intellectual property rights so we can have innovation. I think that is good news. Europe has actually a very robust biotech and pharmaceutical sector. 5 out of the 10 largest biotech or pharmaceutical companies in the world are in Europe, not necessarily in the EU, because 2 of them are in the UK and 2 of them are in Switzerland. But it's still, it's in our region, and that is good. While we might lag behind a lot when it comes to the tech sector in Europe and innovative startups, large scale startups, we're actually really good in biotech. So that is good. But then I'm sometimes a bit confused when people say we actually need to make these vaccines free or much cheaper, and medicine need to get cheaper, because exactly those good institutions we have in Europe, which is a strong protection of intellectual property, which gradually has been eroding over the last couple of years, and we see several EU member states fighting against this, but these very institutions have led to this success and the success being made in the European Union. So if we want to be more resilient, and that's a word or term also being used many times in the pharmaceutical strategy, if we want to be resilient for future pandemics, because probably COVID will not be the last public health problem we've been facing, we need to strengthen these good institutions and incentives and not erode them. Because without these incentives, we would not have companies investing billions and venture capitalists backing these companies, because BioNTech is actually also a success story, one of the few success stories of good European venture capital, because the initial capital came from 2 German twin brothers who were in the generics business beforehand, cashed out, and actually then really wanted to use their money to invest in very risky, innovative medicine. So on the IP side, I'm fairly pleased what the Commission so far has been saying, though not everything is very concrete. But then on the other hand, they use the term accessibility. And accessibility is a euphemism for we need to have very strong price controls for drugs. So the EU now tries to bring the pricing, the decision how much a drug should be priced for and how much national governments and health insurance should reimburse for, to a European level. And that is very concerning, because it is no secret that we have very massive wealth and prosperity disparities among different EU member states. Bulgaria is very different to Sweden or the Netherlands. And by trying to have like one size fits all strategy on which where patients across the entire block can access a drug, we probably get a race to the bottom, which would mean that we have probably lower prices for existing drugs. That's maybe initially good news for patients and the public, but then drug companies will be very hesitant to develop drugs for the European market or bring them to the European market. So we get in a position Canada is already in, where it will take years from Europeans being able to access a drug. Maybe even if the drug has been developed in Europe, we will still not get it. years after, for instance, Americans got it. And this is very concerning. And it's a bit like the wolf in sheep's clothes called accessibility. That's not good news because we want to have more and not less innovation.
You're making good points here, but the question of accessibility is also about the supply chain. So what the Commission says is we want to avoid something that happened in March and April where we can't have access to medicine. And for instance, the Commissioner says that we need to have autonomy. We need to have production in Europe in order to make that happen. Let me just briefly go to the second clip. This is also from the press conferences. Again, the Commissioner, Kyriakides.
Protectionism is not in the DNA of the European Union. That said, our open strategic autonomy is a major political objective of this strategy, and I would say it's also a lesson learned from the COVID-19 crisis, and I personally know what this means when we had export bans from third world countries and found out that we were dependent on APIs and other medicines totally from other parts of the world. So we need to move in a different direction, but we will, of course, be remaining open to trade. But we need to gain a better understanding of the supply chain and understand its vulnerabilities, assess, and then be able to move forward with the changes that we need to do.
So you mentioned intellectual property and price controls, and the factor is that in Europe a lot of our medicine comes from abroad, and we are dependent on these supply chains. So the Commission says, well, if we just produced all of these things here and had all of our innovation here in Europe, it wouldn't be that big of a deal because we wouldn't be dependent of other countries. How is that achievable? And what do you think the consequences of some of the actions of the European Commission could be?
So first of all, I totally share the sentiment that it would be bad if we suddenly cannot access active ingredients or ingredients for pharmaceuticals, and hence also not the end product, because of some political games by authoritarian countries. I mean, the big example or the elephant in the room is usually China. I know India also has done some of these things. Actually, especially India being a country not respecting intellectual property. And India is usually on the forefront with some other countries from the Southern Hemisphere to erode intellectual property on WTO level. When it comes to research of pharmaceuticals, I mean, we want to have the brightest brains of the world working together on cures and vaccines. And by just saying we just go European way, I mean, just in the greater region of Boston, they're probably the brightest minds, or some of the brightest minds in the world working on this. In Japan, they are. I can see that there's some hesitance when it comes to being dependent on countries with very strong regimes that might play some geopolitical games. But when it comes to generally global supply chains, we should not undermine these. And at the end of the day, if you look at the business model of pharmaceutical companies, they make nearly 90% of their profits in Europe, Japan, and the United States. So it's in their interest. They have the incentive that they can sell drugs to patients. And probably some of the political maneuvers of this year's lesson learned, but I don't think that we need additional regulation for this. It's just that companies probably will adjust because they want to meet patients' need, because that's how these companies make money. Yeah, I mean, a pharmaceutical company is not interested in not accessing their raw products or their intermediate goods to be able to actually refine the product and get it to patients. So I'm not sure if we really need the EU to do something. Sometimes it also feels that they feel they need to do something because of COVID. But to be honest, the private sector is doing a lot. BioNTech was actually one of the companies that refused any government support. They refused US and European government support because they didn't want to deal with red tape for a couple of months, but they just wanted to get their project, you know, in the subspace and, you know, find a cure. And that's exactly what they did. And they were the fastest. Those companies that actually initially were just courting governments for grants were not focused on research. Because even the CEO of this company, BioNTech, basically from day one was just like, I'm a scientist and I want to find a cure. I don't want to deal with like some bilateral meetings and get photo shoots of politicians wearing masks. No, I want to actually just focus on this. And that's what they did. So Pfizer, which is a much bigger company, helps them actually manufacturing it, gave them a large grant just to that they have the financial liquidity to work on these things and focus nearly the entire company on this.
Thank you, Fred, for that part. I have a second thing I want to get to, a second topic that I want to get to. We now talked about the prices and the prices of pharmaceuticals. Here, the Commission is of the opinion that we should pay as little as possible. However, there's another place where the Commission apparently believes we should pay more. This is when we talk about the European Green Deal. I have a little clip to start you off. This is the Commissioner Frans Timmermans. He's in charge of the European Green Deal, and he spoke in front of the Agriculture Committee about this environmental project, and he had this to say.
I believe that one of the Achilles heels of the way we consume food and foodstuff is that we've gotten used to everything being very, very cheap. And I honestly believe that if there is a revaluation and health gets a bigger priority, then the willingness to pay a bit more for better foodstuffs might increase.
So, yes, he does recognize that some consumers have to look for the cheaper options, but overall we should all pay more to be more sustainable. Is this a common theme? Are we supposed to pay more for everything with this European Green Deal? What do you think, Fred?
This is Foodie France speaking again. It's not the first time he has complained about food being too cheap. I mean, as executive vice president of the European Commission, he makes more than 265,000 euros a year and barely pays taxes. Probably he attends a lot of business luncheons and dinners where he also doesn't have to pay. I'm not sure how often he actually goes to the supermarket a year or orders something on Amazon Fresh. But it's really interesting, Bill, what you said, that there is this dichotomy between we need to have cheaper drugs, but oh, our food is too cheap, which is a bit of a slap in the face for everybody who is actually struggling with their at the end of the month to actually get bills paid. And I've not really met normal people who've complained about food being too cheap. Sometimes I'm really happy that food is cheap because I can buy an entire chicken and some great vegetables, feed three people, and pay less than 7 euros for all of this. And it's a delicious meal and very nutritious. But that is a good thing.
We have about a minute left in this recording, and I wanted to very briefly ask you about something in there, because we talked about the European Green Deal and its effects. There was this interesting impact assessment by the European Commission on the European Green Deal. Can you very briefly just line out in closing what that found, and why do you think people should be a bit more interested in what the European Green Deal really does?
The impact assessment of the European Commission, that's their own impact assessment, has found out that about 500,000 jobs will be lost in Europe, especially in manufacturing. And we're already losing a lot of jobs because of this pandemic. So I'm not sure if we can afford another 500,000 jobs being lost. Our prosperity will be negatively impacted. Our GDP will decline because of this transition. And that's interesting. So on the one hand, we want to have affordability of medicines. And actually the way to do this, especially in the poorer regions of the European Union, is increased prosperity. We need to grow salaries, we need to grow the economy, and then people can actually afford and have more access to drugs. And by pushing this Green Deal on European consumers, we will create the opposite. We'll be poorer at the end and can afford less of anything. And apparently food is supposed to get more expensive. That's a political will. Timmermans even said, I believe. You know, it's more like a religious thing. I mean, why don't we use these impact assessments, use data and see, oh, this has nothing to do with belief. This is just, these are calculations that will show it will make us poorer. Let's not go down that way.
And that concludes this week's episode of Consumer. Thanks so much for tuning in. Please leave us a review wherever you listen to podcasts and subscribe to our nifty little newsletter on consumerchoicecenter.org. As always, I'm your host, Bill Wirtz, as Billy Joel is playing us out. See you Thursday. You have-